You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
Moving on, let's talk about the Ragnar Locker ransomware gang. This is actually really interesting, and this is a new and kind of scary tactic that we are seeing in ransomware. Ragnar Locker is now warning you if they hit you that they will leak your stolen data, and if you contact law enforcement like the FBI, they will essentially leak your data. Now, the threat also applies to victims contacting data recovery experts to attempt decryption and conduct negotiation processes. Meaning, if your company gets breached, and let's say you hire me, because this is actually one of the things that we do, it's part of my day job, to go ahead and negotiate these ransoms down and to see if I can get your data back. If you talk to somebody like me, now they're threatening, well, if we sent a negotiator, we are going to go ahead and basically leak your data out onto the dark web. So obviously that's a huge, huge problem. Hopefully you never have to deal with Ragnar Locker. Moving on, let's talk about the Virginia National Guard, because email accounts connected to the Virginia Defense Force and the Virginia Department of Military Affairs were impacted by a cyber attack in July, according to a spokesperson from the Virginia National Guard. Now, the organization was notified in July about a possible cyber threat against the Virginia Defense Force and began an investigation immediately, in coordination with state and federal cybersecurity and law enforcement authorities, to determine what was impacted. Now, they confirmed that the incident was not a ransomware attack, might be a business email compromise scam. And if you didn't know, the Virginia Defense Force is an all-volunteer reserve of the Virginia National Guard. So heads up to you in the state of Virginia. Moving on, let's talk about the country of Morocco, because the personal data of more than 2 million Moroccans was leaked by hackers on September 3rd. This is basically, they exposed the identity, profession, employer name, and email address of 2 million Moroccan citizens. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because the attacker employed the use of a social networking site, namely LinkedIn, to retrieve this information. And this database containing leaked information has been circulating on the dark web for several weeks at this point. But it's very interesting to see just how much information and data can be scraped from LinkedIn. And LinkedIn also went through a massive data breach itself 7 years ago or so, 6-7 years ago in 2015. So obviously a huge, huge problem. But heads up, if you're a Moroccan citizen and you happen to be listening to this, moving on, let's talk about the French government's visa website, because the personal data of visa applicants hoping to visit or immigrate to France has been exposed in a cyber attack targeting the France visa's website. Now, France's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Ministry of the Interior, which jointly managed this site, said the attack took place on August 10th and was quickly neutralized. The compromised data, though, is details entered in during visa applications, including email addresses, first and last names, dates of birth, nationalities, passport numbers, or national identity cards. No financial or sensitive data as defined by the GDPR was compromised, according to France. Now, the press release did not disclose how many individuals are impacted or a range of dates with which these applications were compromised. But if you have immigrated to France or thinking about it and applied, or you've applied for a travel visa to France, you might want to check in with the French government. Moving on, let's talk about the United Nations, because they confirmed that their infrastructure was breached earlier this year. Additional attacks linked to the earlier breach have also been detected and are now under investigation. And I quote, "We can confirm that unknown attackers were able to breach parts of the United Nations infrastructure in April of 2021. Now, attackers likely broke into UN infrastructure using a stolen name and password of a UN employee bought on the dark web. Now, I just talked about that with Fortinet. Same kind of situation here. Now, these credentials basically gave access to the attacker to an account for what is known as Moja. This is the UN's proprietary project management software. The account attackers accessed basically this, and it wasn't protected by multi-factor authentication. And from this entry point, the attackers could further infiltrate the UN network, and essentially Re-Security, a cybersecurity outfit, found this breach and claims that the earliest known date that the attackers accessed the systems was on April 5 and were active as of August 7th. So somebody got into the United Nations and has been poking around. Obviously not a good thing. This is why we need to change our passwords regularly. This is why we need multi-factor authentication in everything in our lives, including the Facebooks of the world, not just your banks. And finally, And we've got a couple finalies for you. We are going to be talking about WhatsApp, which is the privacy-violating security app that Facebook claims is secure for private communications. You may have WhatsApp on your phone right now. You definitely want to hear this. Now, it's been a long time coming, but Facebook is finally feeling some heat from Europe's much-trumpeted data protection regime, which is Ireland's Data Protection Commission, which just announced a $267 million fine against WhatsApp. Now, the Facebook-owned messaging app has been under investigation by the Irish DPC, its lead data supervisor in the EU, since December of 2018, several months after the first complaints basically were fired at WhatsApp over how it processes user data under the Europe's General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. Now, despite receiving a number of specific complaints about WhatsApp, the investigation undertaken by the DPC has been decided today, and essentially, not today, excuse me, like 2 weeks ago or so from when we're talking about this. And essentially, the DPC did this on their own volition, meaning that they selected the parameters for the investigation themselves, choosing to fix in on an audit of WhatsApp's transparency obligations. Now, if you didn't know, a key principle of the GDPR is that entities which are processing your data must be clear, open, and honest with those people about how their information will be used. That is the last thing that Facebook has ever done. Now, its inquiry considered whether or not WhatsApp fulfills transparency obligations to both users and non-users of its service. WhatsApp may, for example, upload phone numbers of non-users if you agree to it, basically if you agree rather to WhatsApp ingesting your phone book, which contains people's data. Meaning, let's say I'm in your phone book, I don't have WhatsApp. You install WhatsApp and it says, hey, can we grab your phone book? Now Facebook has just ingested my phone number, even though I don't have a Facebook account or, excuse me, a WhatsApp account. That's obviously a huge, huge problem. So in sum, the DPC found a range of transparency infringements by WhatsApp. And in addition to that huge financial penalty, it's ordered WhatsApp to take a number of actions to improve its level of transparency. And that's obviously a huge, huge thing. Now, what also came out on top of this, which is the other basic slam for against WhatsApp, is that it was recently disclosed, and Facebook's own director at WhatsApp confirmed it, that they have always claimed end-to-end privacy, meaning if it's on your device, it's encrypted and only you can read it. As it goes to the internet, it's encrypted and only you can read it. And when it gets to the person that you're sending it to, it's encrypted and only they can read it. That's essentially end-to-end encryption. Facebook just admitted that they are violating that because they basically have an army of 1,000+ users in Austin, Texas, in Singapore, and also in Ireland that are actually going through this content. So if you report something on WhatsApp, they are actually reading it. So let's say I send you something and you say, hey, wait a second, that's not right. You report it to WhatsApp. A human being will review that. That is exact opposite of end-to-end encryption. If you think you are safe and secure using WhatsApp, as your data is moving in transit over the internet, it is very possible that Facebook has the ability to decrypt that and read that. Otherwise, it would be safe, but you're on your device. They will do this. And I did a video / podcast, I want to say a couple years ago at this point, talking about the artificial intelligence they were actually applying to WhatsApp to actually scan the messages and all of that. WhatsApp is not secure. It's not secure like an app like Signal, for example, which is known secure. It's run by a nonprofit. It is true end-to-end encryption. And as far as we know, that has never, ever been in doubt, and it's been third-party audited. WhatsApp is not secure. They are data breaching you every time you use that thing, especially if you've reported somebody. But if they can read the reported ones, they can read any WhatsApp app on your phone. It is not that secure. And finally, and I try to stay away from these things, but we actually need to talk about U.S. voting data from a Colorado county. Now, this one actually happened around a month ago or so, right around the time of Mike Lindell. You may know him as the MyPillow guy's cyber symposium. And yes, there's actually a tie to that here. And if you didn't know, I live tweeted that entire thing. I've written articles on the cyber symposium as to why we got absolutely nothing. I actually did a deep dive on it on this radio show as to why Mike Lindell didn't give us any proof, but this ties into this. Now, I wanted to wait for more information to come out in this case, because I'm not diving into the political side of this. I just want to talk about the facts of this particular situation. And here's what's happened. Sensitive data about voting equipment in Colorado's Mesa County was posted online. Now, at the center of this criminal investigation into how that information was released is County Clerk Tina Peters, whose whereabouts currently remain unknown. She hasn't returned to work in Mesa County since the data breach was announced, and that is the tie-in to Lindell Cyber Symposium. The news of that criminal act was basically announced live right there by Ron Watkins. Now, you may know him as Code Monkey. He is allegedly Q of QAnon fame. He owns 4chan and 8kun, which is what now is what 4chan is called, basically the dregs of the internet. And essentially, a lot of people believe, including an HBO documentary that followed him around for like years, that he is actually Q. He started this whole mess. Now, Mr. Watkins was allegedly at the Cyber Symposium looking at a forensic copy of a Dominion voting server live. I was actually watching him do this when his lawyer called and told him to stop. And he was also told Ms. Tina Peters, was allegedly involved. So one reason why the Mesa County security breach is particularly significant is because it uses equipment from Dominion Voting Systems, one of the country's largest vendors of election equipment. The company is also at the center, obviously, of many conspiracy theories about the 2020 election that claim the ballot counting was somehow rigged against former President Donald Trump. If you didn't know, Dominion is pursuing a number of defamation suits against basically pro-Trump news outlets, as well as President Trump's former advisors, such as Rudy Giuliani and some others. Now, Ms. Peters is reportedly being sheltered by Mr. Lindell, who's also facing lawsuits by Dominion Voting. If those reports are true, then Mr. Lindell could be facing criminal charges himself, as he's aiding and abetting a potential felon. Now, this basically shows problems at the clerk's office, and it shows that it extends beyond Ms. Peters as well, because about a week ago or so, her deputy, Belinda Kinsley, was charged with second-degree burglary and a cybercrime over entering the building while she was suspended pending an investigation into unprofessional and inappropriate conduct in the workplace. About a week ago or so, Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold filed a lawsuit to prevent Peters from having any role in the county's upcoming fall election. Basically, the claim is because she is a hyper-partisan, if she runs the voting in that county, she could alter the votes herself, and that therefore it wouldn't be fair. She's not impartial. Now, if there were duplicates of Dominion voting servers that were put out into the public, this is also a grave security risk to the integrity of the election process, where Dominion equipment is used in the United States. The ability to understand how to tamper with or alter these machines could make it easy to do that for an upcoming election. Dominion itself is now in a bind because they have to basically start changing up their coding, their configurations, and essentially try to make these leaked images irrelevant, meaning these images are out there. We don't know who has them, who's trying to reverse engineer them. And so they essentially have to rewrite the script so that you can't use anything you find as an exploit in those leaked images in any new system. But it gets worse than that, because also all of the counties that use their equipment now need to update it, and that's a massive and costly endeavor. And while there have been allegations of voter fraud or manipulation in the 2020 election, there has been no reporting by any official governing body, including the Homeland Security CISA, that indicated there was a massive collusion anywhere in the country. And that's an indisputable fact. I am not talking about news outlets. I am not talking about opinions. I am talking about a governing body like the CISA that oversaw the cybersecurity side of the 2020 election. No formal government body has come out and said there was a problem with this. That is basically an indisputable fact. We can speculate. We can do whatever we want. I'm just telling you the facts on the ground. Now, You may believe the election was tampered with, and I'm not telling you what to believe or not. I am telling you everything right here simply as it stands. 2022, the next one, the midterm election, is going to be the most scrutinized election in U.S. history, and it would appear that if these allegations against Ms. Peters are correct, we've got basically 1 year to harden the entire basically election even more as people are looking into these stolen images and to see how they can tamper with this. This is a huge, huge problem that we've got, and I deeply fear that we are going to have problems in 2022 with this. Voting machines are not going to be updated and hardened in time, or they're going to be reused, or, you know, we have laws changing that may affect that in some way, shape, or form. Not to mention, there are people that are simply disillusioned with voting and said, well, if it's all rigged, I'm just not going to show up and vote. And there you go. And that is really, I think, against the democratic way of this country. So whatever you believe is what you believe. I'm not here to adjudicate that. I've said it a million times that cybersecurity is agnostic to politics, but we're not immune from it. And with that, good luck, my fellow Americans. Those were your breaches of the week.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the Deep Dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a Deep Dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
And this topic is near and dear to my heart for this deep dive. We're basically talking about Afghanistan, but not in the way that you've heard on the news. You're just not getting this, quite frankly, anywhere else. And I wrote an article about this a few weeks ago. It actually was published on September 2nd, and it's called The Afghans' Next Challenge, Erasing Their Digital Footprint. And I've seen almost nobody talk about this, but it is very, very difficult. And here's what's going on. The world watched in horror as the Taliban marched through all of Afghanistan in only 10 days to reclaim it from the American-supported Afghan government. The U.S. forces had little time to properly evacuate everyone and everything by the August 31st deadline, and our news feeds were filled with images and videos of the mad rush to leave the country, along with a shocking suicide attack by ISIS-K that took 13 American lives and the lives of dozens of Afghanis. Now, the choices made by the Biden administration and the military establishment will be debated for quite some time. I suspect decades. You know, everybody's going to armchair quarterback this one. In the short term, however, the global community must ensure that human rights are preserved by the new Taliban government. And one of the most concerning aspects of that mission is the digital footprints of our Afghan allies. And I think it's going to be hard enough to get the Taliban to adhere to human rights. They have an atrocious track record with it. But with this digital footprint, it becomes even more terrifying. Now, part of the nation-building exercise that the United States performed on Afghanistan was an attempt to modernize its infrastructure to ensure fair and open elections. By virtue of wanting to elect a government that was actually chosen by the people, biometric systems from German company Dermalog were used to verify the identities of each eligible Afghan citizen. These systems would match Afghan citizens via photographs and fingerprints into the system in order to ensure that both the person was who they claimed to be, but also that they couldn't vote more than once. And it was a clumsy system. It took about 10 minutes to actually verify a citizen, but the net effect of these 40,000 Dermalog biometric devices was that the general Afghan population was identified and logged into a centralized system along with their democratic choices of who they saw fit to lead the country. That's what they did. That's a huge problem. Now, on top of this, the United States military was using HIIDE devices that they were using to basically run biometric scans and iris scans of those that they considered enemy combatants or terrorists, but also the Afghan support personnel, think translators and all of that, that were helping the Afghan government as well as the United States military. And so between the 40,000 Dermalog devices that in the mad rush to leave the country were were most likely almost all left behind, not to mention these HIIDE devices, we've got a serious problem, because now that the Taliban has taken over, these biometric databases could literally spell death for scores of Afghan citizens that their new leadership considers a threat, an apostate, or simply undesirable. Given the fast and sudden evacuation of not only the United States, but also top Afghanistan government leaders, we have left behind not only a ton of military equipment, but also these biometric identity systems, as I just mentioned. That has to be terrifying. Just, I can't imagine. It has to be terrifying for the thousands of Afghan citizens that assisted the United States military and their fledgling government, including the translators, their families. They've all been desperately trying to leave for the United States, and they were left behind. And I think that's one of those things that is going to be debated for years, because we should have pulled the translators out. These are people that helped us, supported us. We as a country made promises to them. It is just heartbreaking. So when the U.S. established a new government, or rather the new government in Afghanistan, the internet was still in its infancy. But during our occupation, a new generation of Afghans were raised under that government with access to Google, Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, TikTok, Instagram, and other major platforms that exposed them to the rest of the world, and they were thriving. When I was doing research for this, it was very interesting to see that much of Afghanistan was actually blanketed by both 3G and 4G wireless technology. And so they were using Androids and iPhones and everything else, just like the rest of us. And I think that is basically to their credit. They were thriving, not to mention that there is an entire generation of Afghanis that are basically never knew Taliban rule. They were born after it, or they were too young to really remember it. And so what they remember is a free and open society. And about 75% of the entire Afghan population is something like under the age of 45. So it's a huge, huge youth population that is ensconced in technology. But the Taliban, with their strict religious codes for women and requirements of conformity to their centuries-old traditions, is in charge of the internet service providers in the country. This means that as the government, they can force these internet service providers to turn over data on their users. We're talking phone numbers, GPS locations, where the devices are going on the internet, not to mention the actual names, genders, and other identifying information. That's crazy. When the government controls the internet, free expression is censored and the citizens are heavily tracked. China, for example, has been making inroads into dozens of countries with their Belt and Road Initiative, which, aside from infrastructure like roads, they're also bringing an authoritarian brand of government-owned internet. And on top of it, if you think about it, with the trillions of dollars worth of rare earth metals in Afghanistan, it's in China's best interest to align with the Taliban to help them maintain control of the country while they team up to and extract the metals. We might have a Taliban government that's worth trillions of dollars, while the Chinese are also making trillions of dollars in the long run here as well. Now, if that happens, the Taliban will have one of the most sophisticated ways of censoring and tracking their citizens, thanks to the Chinese government. Many predict that social media will remain open in Afghanistan because the Taliban themselves have become rather adept at using it. However, what they fail to see is that who controls the internet also controls the flow of information. It's no wonder that the freest generation of Afghans are now hurrying to erase their digital footprints before the Taliban achieves this level of control and sees what they're actually posting on TikTok or Facebook or wherever they're using. And if this situation underscores anything, it's that once humans have become interconnected, we share prolifically. For most democratic nations, that level of sharing is fine, even encouraged. But for a dictatorial regime, that level of openness can result in punitive action or execution against the citizens. In the evolving emergency that is the safety and security of the Afghan people, Western companies need to get involved. Facebook, Twitter, Google, Spotify, even the China-based TikTok and others need to create an easy way to allow anyone to suspend and hide or even permanently delete their profiles posts, search history, listening, viewing histories, listening history, all that kind of stuff. This would have the net effect of allowing the Facebooks of the world to deny governmental requests for user information from the Taliban. And so far, the news media only seems to be querying the social media platforms on how they will handle the Taliban's accounts themselves. So Facebook has come out and said that the Taliban cannot have official accounts because they're considered a terrorist group. Pretty much all social media has come out and said that, except for Twitter. Twitter said, yeah, they can have accounts, providing they don't break our terms of services. I personally think that until they are recognized as a formal government in the United Nations, that no requests for this kind of information should be granted. So if the Taliban says, hey, we see these journalists over here, let's go ahead and... let's go ahead and capture them, and we want their Facebook information, Facebook should say no. Now, Afghan citizens may not be able to do much about a potentially seized biometric database with their unique information in it, but if they need to scrub their histories and hide, this is ideally what they should do. And this goes to any of you that basically want to get off the grid, because think about this. Governments come and go. This is a huge problem. Regime change, where you are losing a democracy and instead gaining an authoritarian as a leader, can spell real trouble with social media because we are aggregating so much of this information. We just had an attack on January 6th here in the United States that if the government had changed hands and we stopped being a democracy into whatever that would have assumed, would there be a potential terror campaign against people that disagreed with that new government? We're so used to just having our constitutional rights, but when they go away, what happens? These are things to consider. This is not a call to action or anything. It's something to consider in your own personal life. And so if you want to scrub anything and everything that you can, I really recommend that you do the following. I would go into your social media accounts and I would delete all posts, all search histories, music and viewing histories, and anything else, in this case, that the Taliban may not like as I'm talking to the Afghan population. Then I would delete those accounts and I would set up brand new clean accounts, meaning you have accounts and the only thing that's tied are very plain and basic things. You're posting on the weather as opposed to why you hate the Taliban or whatever you're posting. Then I would use the erase feature that comes integrated with Apple's iPhone or Google's Android. This will wipe out any potential evidence on the device. And so if the device is seized, going in and forensically attempting to get that data back is incredibly difficult to do, primarily because the erase feature that both iPhone and Android have overwrites the data instead of just deleting it like a standard format on a Windows machine, which I can easily recover. So I highly recommend doing that. And we ran a little long this week, so I don't have time for my normal exit music and all of that. But thanks for sticking with the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. I'll see you next time.